Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua Nygren. Today, I'll be talking with Emily Wakehild and Michelle Berry about their new book, A Primer for Teaching Environmental History, 10 Design Principles. Emily is Professor of History and Director of Environmental Studies at Boise State University. Michelle is Assistant Professor of Practice in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and a lecturer in the History Department at the University of Arizona. Emily and Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thank you for having us.
I'm wondering if we could begin just by maybe telling us a little bit about yourselves, how you came to be teachers and scholars. And Emily, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I think that I have always been an environmental historian. I think I could say that. I think my interests have always sort of blended that way. But I think I really became one after my undergraduate degree. I joined a program called Teach for America. Mm-hmm. And I taught in the lower Rio Grande Valley of Texas along the U.S.-Mexico border. And I taught science and social studies to sixth graders. And the pairing of science and social studies wasn't something that happened a lot in undergraduate experiences. But for sixth grade, it really allowed me to explore the ways that science and social science complement each other. And so I think that primed me to head to graduate school with that blending already in my mind. Mm-hmm. I went to graduate school because I was obsessed with Latin America and I wanted to study social revolution and social change. And so it wasn't until I got there that I knew that there was something called environmental history and sort of started to pursue that direction. But I think that exposure came from the blending and really, at least in my story, through teaching and being able to teach both the science objectives and social science and geography objectives allowed me to kind of explore those relationships in a way that was not academic, but that exposed the ways they bleed into each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think my path began in sixth grade. Or maybe before. I grew up in rural Western Colorado in the 70s and 80s, and not only being part of sort of an agricultural community, but also living in a place where there wasn't much to do in terms of recreation and leisure other than play in the outdoors. And so I came into undergraduate school at Colorado College heavily steeped in my own personal relationships with the non-human world. And then I got there and I think I probably wanted to do science. I may be a little bit like Emily and decided that I wasn't really keen on, taking organic chemistry or some of his other bears of classes. And I discovered Ann Hyde at Colorado College, who said to me, there's this thing called environmental history. And I was sold. So from that point forward, I pretty much studied environmental U.S. West history even as an undergraduate. And then when I was looking for graduate schools, really wanted a program that offered me the opportunity to work with folks who were in that field. And University of Arizona was where I landed and how I met Emily Wakehild.
Yay.
Yeah. Your relationship and your friendship, I think, really does shine through in this book throughout from cover to cover. So I'm wondering, could you tell me a little bit about how this book came about? How did you get the idea to collaborate on a book about teaching environmental history?
That's a great question. And I wish this is Emily again. And I wish we could take credit for the idea, but it is actually an idea that belongs to Antoinette Burton, who authored a primer for teaching world history with Duke. And she did it out of a sort of need to share her experience teaching a 100 level intro world history class as they became more and more common. And after she did it, Duke was just floored by how well it sold and how much interest there was in it. And so she asked if she could turn it into a series. And she knew that she wanted in the series one of the first books to be environmental. And I didn't realize it, but she had me out to Illinois, the University of Illinois, to run a workshop with teachers. And that was, I think, my interview for the book. And it turns out I passed. So after the Saturday morning workshop with the teacher, she asked if I'd be interested in the idea. And I was 7 months pregnant at the time. And while I love the idea, I also wasn't sure that I could do it alone. And I immediately thought of Michelle. I think I texted her right after that conversation and said, I have a proposal for you. And I think that there is this kind of, what was compelling about Antoinette's pitch was that this is a space that historians should be writing in, that there is scholarly writing about, you know, research, but there is not scholarly research-informed writing about teaching, and that there should be. That new scholars need it, scholars that are entering into a new field need it, and it's a place where historians have a lot to say, but they haven't generally had credit given for doing it. You know, it's not a thing that people count on tenure profiles, and it's not something that we're asked to do. And I immediately thought of collaborating with Michelle as I was a TA in one of her environmental history classes at the University of Arizona, and how fun that was and how much we both learned from each other. And so I asked if she would join in that. And I would like to say also that I think that there's this general insecurity about writing about teaching, I mean, in talking about teaching in general, but especially writing about it. And so one of the things we tried to do in the book is just sort of open it up as a process and not a definitive way, but as a place where all teaching improves when it's nested within a community. And Michelle and I have relied on each other for that community for years. But we hadn't thought about what it would be like to bring other people into that conversation. And so I think we thought about the book as a platform for potentially doing that.
Yeah, I would just add that I, you know, had my interview for the book offer in the early 2000s, and I passed. And then I thought I ended up not going on the higher education job market after graduating with my PhD and ended up teaching secondary at an independent high school here in town, juniors and seniors. And it was a academically rigorous college prep school. And so I really, for the last, you know, decade, well, the last 20 years, but really, really intensively for a decade, spent time full time in the classroom. And so when Emily asked, I was like, oh, this is going to be so cool. This is just going to be fun to think about in a more systematic way, the experiences and the thoughts and the ideas that I've generated over a decade in the classroom full time. So that was cool.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this, both of your love for teaching and this kind of, I think you do a really good job of, as Emily said, sort of demystifying the process, but also making the reader feel okay to take a risk and to risk failure. that really comes through in this book. And that's really, the book is filled with the sort of sense of invitation for readers to participate, to take risks, but also participate with you, with the two of you in the pedagogical process. And you write, pedagogy is a process or a shared endeavor. So I'm wondering, how did you approach this book in terms of, you know, what did you intend, how do you intend readers to use this book, to read the book? And then stemming from that, you know, how did that sort of approach to the book itself influence the way you wrote about it, whether, you know, what sort of things you emphasized or the sort of contents that you highlighted and so on?
This is Michelle. I can start this one. I think that one of the challenges for us in writing the book was that Antoinette Burton wanted the book to not just reach professors in higher education, but also reach high school educators. And so thinking about audience and thinking about all the different classrooms in which this book might, you know, sort of inform best practices was probably early on. One of our earliest conversations was, how do we strike, how do we reach out to that vast audience of differentiated classrooms and speak a little bit to everybody? And so one of the emphases of the book and one of the intentions of the book is that it's useful to practitioners of education in a lot of different school settings. And so we've heard, I've worked with some high school educators, thanks to the amazing Flannery Burke right there in Missouri. And, you know, those were high school educators and they were super jazzed up about the ideas and what have you. And so I think thinking about audience in that way informed a lot of the kind of assignments and activities we discussed, but also inform the ways in which we talked about environmental history content, because we didn't want to just speak to specialists of any particular area of environmental history. And we also didn't want to talk to specialists in any particular area of education. And so because of that, you know, so then it was like this, oh, is this too general? And, you know, is this going to be useful for anybody? Are we watering it down too much? And so that was something we struggled with throughout the writing. And that's why it was super cool to be collaborative, because we could kind of bounce stuff off of each other.
Right.
And so the intention is that lots of people can use this book in lots of different ways.
And I would add to that, that to sort of complement what Michelle said, that that both of us see environmental history everywhere. And so, you know, even if what we're teaching is not, you know, if I'm teaching a class on Latin American social change, well, embedded within that is the access to resources, especially land, right? And so we wanted to help other people to kind of see it in that way as well. And so this framework of environmental history as separate was something that we wanted to try and break down with both the structure of the book pitched at people that might be teaching, as you said, Josh, a class on environmental history, but also those that might be looking for some sort of unit or module or even just, you know, one monograph to put in an upper division class on a different topic. And so we wanted to help other people use it in that way as well.
I think, yeah, I think all of this really is evident in the book. You know, this is a book you could sit down and read cover to cover, or you can kind of take it off the shelf as needed. And, you know, I've got a lesson plan on this. I'm planning my syllabus and I need to cover that. And I think it helps whether you're kind of building something from the ground up or rebuilding something from the ground up, or just trying to, as you say, like add a little bit of environmental history into existing courses. and one, I guess one of the, I see in the structure of the book, you know, the beginning, you're really talking about, you know, approaching the course, you're talking about designing it, like what sort of general principles, how are you going to conceive of the course as a whole? And then you end sort of with assessment. So it's kind of taking the arc of a course in many ways. So starting with these tips and principles for designing a course, one of the key considerations that you argue is that early on in the course, a lot of educators might need to convince students that environmental history matters, that it's relevant. So I'm wondering if you could explain some of the strategies that you found useful in conveying that and convincing students.
Yeah, I think Michelle and I both share an approach to teaching that meets students where they are and helps them to get to a place where we think they should go. And I think part of that is showing them how environmental history is relevant in their daily lives. And again, this idea that we see it everywhere, but it's helping students who don't necessarily see it everywhere. And so one of the examples we use in the book is the banana, right? And, you know, entering students' lives through their diet, through what they eat, and showing them how that banana isn't just, you know, something that appears, but it has a really fascinating transnational environmental history that helps them kind of understand the ecological moment that we're in right now. I would also say on this point, and I'm sure Michelle has more to say about some of the strategies as well, but there are some things that we wanted the book not to be.
And I think that there was potential that the book could have been sort of a different class in each chapter, you know, a class on U.S. environmental history, a class on global. And we really tried to not make it that, because that's just sort of going over a syllabus. And one of the things that we have a lot of access to is other people's syllabi. But what we don't talk about is what's behind the syllabi and what choices go into that and how you translate that syllabus into in-class activities and assignments and interactions with students that are meaningful. And so we really endeavored to try and structure the book and to offer strategies that kind of run the whole gamut, right? That sort of describe a semester-long research assignment, but that also describe how it is you set up a discussion and the ways you facilitate that discussion in a way that gets them to a place in environmental history that they didn't walk in the door anticipating they would get to. And so that's certainly one of the strategies, is to think about just the mechanics and the pedagogy of teaching in a way that isn't laid bare on a syllabus.
Yeah, I won't add much more to that other than to say that I think the strategy is local and personal for, for me, in terms of trying to get them to understand students, to understand relevance. And sometimes that means having asking them to do just a quick, short kind of activity around their local place, if that's available. But, you know, sometimes it's just really about, you don't have to necessarily think historically. You can just think about your right now, like look at your iPhone and let's figure out, you know, what part of non-human nature goes into making that thing? And what is it, you know, how is it connected in this wider way to nature, for lack of a better word? And of course, that's a complicated term, which we try to always complicate in our classes. But but that, even just that, because some of them have never once thought about it. They've never thought about silicon, right? They've never once thought about sort of the coal-powered, you know, plant that powers your, that recharges your phone at night. They don't think about any, or where that coal comes from, or they don't think about any of that stuff. So even just starting there and then thinking historically and thinking about the pasts involved in all of that, it makes their understanding of the iPhone richer and richer. But we just start right where they are. Like, look at that thing sitting in front of you, and let's think about how that sort of involves nature in a variety of different ways. And that right there can just start them thinking about the environment, which is a term they hear all the time, really differently. And it makes it suddenly very personal to them.
Excellent. Yeah. You know, the emphasis on meeting students where they are and kind of making things personal, I think is something that I took away from your book. I've used this book. I read it last summer and used it to restructure my course this wrapping up this semester. You know, it does have quite a bit of payoff when you make that something that you do intentionally. Emily, you mentioned that the importance of kind of structuring your course intentionally, where you connect the learning outcomes, you connect the skill-based objectives to the class activities. I'm wondering if you could give a sense of a couple of the ways that either of you have, you know, applied those general pedagogical principles in an environmental history course.
Yeah, so so one of the main contributions, in my view, of environmental history is deep attention to change over time. And change over time happens in almost every context and you know, sort of any history class. But environmental history asks us to go back, in some cases, even to the Pleistocene. And I think entering that familiarity with scales in the natural world that don't necessarily map perfectly onto scales in the human world is one of those places and one of those opportunities where we can connect this sort of larger learning outcome of change over time, for example, with an understanding of the geological and biophysical cycles of the world. And one place where, you know, I do it in a number of classes is through animals. And we have a separate chapter on animals. And that's the one exception to the book where there's a chapter built around one particular class. And that's largely excused by my obsession right now. It's probably sort of with animals and animal history. And
she's obsessed.
I am so obsessed. Llamas, beavers, whatever. Yeah. Right. All of them. But I mean, I do think that is a a place, the food is the same way, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about the strategy of the banana, but I think animals also help us meet students where they are, mm-hmm. and it allows them to encounter another living being that they're familiar with, but they've never thought about historically. And so that becomes an interesting mm-hmm. entry point. So for example, for the change over time objective, having them consider debates that were ferocious among scientists starting in the 1960s about the die-off of Pleistocene megafauna. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, assign them and have them read some of those original articles, and then we divide up into a debate and try and figure out, you know, was it overtill? Was it overkill? Was it over ill? Was it disease? You know, what are the reasons why these animals no longer roam the world? And that becomes a sort of way of fusing those timescales that allows us to have evidence-based arguments, but not necessarily consensus. And I hope, and I see that as one of the ways of fusing sort of the skills of critical reading and understanding evidence with this sort of larger outcome of understanding change over time.
Yeah, I would just add, the student-centered classroom, I know that's super trendy, and sometimes I don't think we even know really what that means, but I consistently hear from my students how radically different a classroom is in which they get to talk things out and in which they get to explore ideas with one another in a variety of ways, whether it's partnerships, whether it's small group settings, whether it's even collaborative writing, you know, being able to connect with one another to make sense of the history and the world is really meaningful for students. And I think it helps them always reach my learning objectives, which include critical reading, critical writing, and critical communication. Mm-hmm. And so that student-centered classroom, that ability to let them find their voices in trying to make sense of all this stuff, rather than just them sitting there listening to information or even just absorbing information from reading, right? And then trying to spit back the right answer or to show comprehension. I also want them to problem solve. I want them to get together with others to make sense of complicatedness. And they appreciate that. And I think the key to that is just to consistently have a student-centered classroom in which every day the activities are centered around meeting those objectives. And so I'm not much on, you know, there's a place for lecture, but I think the more roundtable stuff you can do, the more common readings in common, and then coming in and sorting out the problems that are involved in those texts, reading against the grain of the text, looking for non-human actors in texts that we traditionally take as being very political, right? Like the Guano Islands Act, which is what I'm going to teach this coming semester, right? There's really interesting. That's all about diplomacy. It's often taught that way, but it's also all about fertilizer and agriculture and the non-human world and collecting bat poop, you know? And so it's like, let's read against the grain and see what else is going on. And to do that collaboratively, I think helps reach the skill-based objectives that I think are really powerful and meaningful and maybe the most important thing students can get out of a history classroom.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's great. And for listeners, some of the strategies that that Michelle just mentioned, like readings in the round and round tables and things like that. Those are elaborated a little bit more in the book. So I do encourage people to pick up a copy and read it, because there's a lot of useful strategies and principles to take away. Earlier we were talking about, you know, how do we, on the one hand, there's ideas here for helping people design an entire course or just a specific class period. But there's also this idea of, well, what if I'm not teaching an environmental history course, but I want to bring environmental history in? So what are some of the ways that you recommend doing so, some of the principles? Do you invite people to make their own?
Yeah, I just wrote for the American Historian, from the Organization of American Historians, a piece in their September issue about just this, about how do you take, for me as a U.S. historian, how do you take a U.S. survey, for example, and infuse it with some environmental history, right, you know, without having to blow the whole thing up and redo it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just really about the way that you view the world. Emily started out the podcast by saying, she and I see environmental history and nature or the environment everywhere in all things. And so, you know, it's one of those things where you already teach about Henry Ford more than likely in a U.S. survey course. Mm. So then just adjusting the lens through which you see that Ford moment can bring in all kinds of really interesting discussions about public health with flooded gas that arrives in the 1920s, and thinking about, you know, the sourcing of the raw materials that are required to go into the automobile industry. And then you could think about space and the requirement of roads and what that does environmentally. Mm. As interstates and highways are built over time from the 20s through the, you know, through today. And so that just sort of that kind of thing where just do what you do and then pick a couple of really key moments when the environment is really, for lack of a better word, simple to see and bring that to your students. And pretty soon, I think you'll start seeing it everywhere and it will just become just like a really great history class includes race and class and gender. Environment will start to be more present in your syllabus and in your classroom. Right.
And I would add to this that, you know, when we were writing the book, I was not in an environmental studies program. And now I'm a director of a program. And over the past 2 years, we've gone through this process of completely revising our program learning outcomes and redoing and adding a core curriculum. And so if I went back and, you know, sort of thought about our book again, I would add a component here that's about environmental history in non-history classes.
Mm. Oh, right.
Because I really think it's essential and I see it everywhere. And I think that that's another extension of this conversation. But when we were writing, we were thinking about how often one person in a department doesn't have the authority to change, you know, the way the intro course works or, you know, how the surveys are taught in terms of the years they cover or the geographical reach. But that there often are these entry points, many of them comparative, that make a lot of sense from an environmental history perspective. So, for example, I used to teach in the Americas in World History class that was mandated, right? It was something that I would teach. And most of the people that taught it were U.S. historians. So as a Latin Americanist, I already had a different perspective. Right. But one of the comparative case studies I developed in there was between the Maya and the Vikings. Both of whom were affected by climate, and both of them, you know, had their civilizations sort of interrupted by natural phenomenon or sort of climate phenomenon. And it was a comparison that you know, sort of doesn't enter into many traditional history classes. But it was one that was really fruitful for the students, and it was useful for me thinking about, what did the Vikings and the Maya have in common?
That's terrific. Yeah. I think that there is something in this book, though, for people, you know, not teaching in a history class, or maybe at the very least, you know, collaboratively teaching. The book talks about ways that, I think you put it at one point, something along the lines of how instructors can bring students to the field, but also bring the field to students, kind of referring to the ways in which you can teach history students more science, but also maybe encourage majors in the sciences to learn more history. So How are ways that you've been able to do that? And what are some of the benefits that students gain from that?
Yeah. And we have the whole chapter on the field, right? Mm. And the field in its dual meanings, both of other fields like biology or ecology or literature, but also the field like going out and into it. And I would say that I now intentionally in all my environmental studies classes build in a site visit to something that we're studying. And I started doing it with the animals course where we took a backstage tour of the zoo and, you know, had a sort of a walk through the dietitian and all the veterinarians and sort of the logistics of the zoo. And then I've been teaching a class that has a component on brownfields and urban remediation. And so we did a site visit and we toured both with an Idaho Department of Environmental Quality expert and the owner what happened to turn a former meth house into a children's theater location. And with almost without exception, there are students that say that for them was what brought it to life or sort of made it happen. And actually seeing things is not the same as reading the documents and reading the report. And by going to the site and seeing it, it sort of brings all of those readings into focus. And I think that is essential to do in history classes where students can become distant from either geographically or sort of mentally or ethically from what their subjects are. And I think that in almost any class, there's a way of doing that. And it's more work. I mean, there's logistics that are involved, you know, it is, you have to plan, there's always students that can't make it, but it far outweighs the challenges by giving them those actual experiences.
Yeah, I would just add too that if you're teaching in a school or in a setting where a site visit like that is not possible, which is true for a lot of people, a lot of people also don't have access to really good, fast internet. But if you do have a digital capacity to get students into the field digitally, there's so, especially for U.S. history, other places too, but especially U.S. history, there's so much compelling, awesome stuff online that students can go, you know, sort of immerse themselves in a photographic essay of the Great Plains, for example, and then go to the Smithsonian Institute that has an amazing online exhibit about the buffalo, including sort of indigenous people's renderings of buffalo and storytelling about buffalo. And then you can have them read, you know, sort of a modern, you know, historian like Dan Flores writing about what actually killed the buffalo and thinking also about, you know, pairing that with a bigger discussion of something like the railroad coming and Mark Feige. And then you do all that stuff. And all of a sudden students, the reading of those texts are infused with, you know, sort of a multimodal experience for students. And this is especially true as we move more into online education. I teach a little bit online. I don't love it, be honest with you, but there is something about forcing online students to actually, you know, sort of not just be so text heavy, but to go look at images online. And that the internet provides us so many opportunities for that I think sometimes we overlook as historians because we are so text specific. And I think I think it just makes it all a little bit more, like Emily said, a little bit more real for students, even though they themselves can't necessarily go walk around in the Great Plains or go touch a buffalo. You know, they can at least sort of begin to see it in a way that simply reading a secondary source or maybe even a smattering of primary sources doesn't necessarily bring it home in quite the same way as the visual part of it. And so I think digital possibilities abound and we should take advantage of those as much as we can, especially for students in classrooms that are not quite as mobile as they are at Boise State, which is such a privilege and a gift that Emily has.
Right.
I would completely echo with what Michelle said. And because she's reminded me of this, one of the things we did was videotape the site visit and make a series of YouTube videos out of it. And so, you know, it's a class that is a core class and will be taught every semester. I can't ask those community partners to give us a tour every semester.
Right.
They have full-time jobs. And so
they did it this time, and now the students can go there virtually. Wow. And next semester, we'll do a site visit somewhere else and videotape that. Oh, cool. Until we have this sort of buildup of those resources in which we can share.
You know, talking about technology, you're discussing ways that technology can, that you found ways to use technology to deliver the content of environmental history. But I think there's also some more, you also discuss some of the ways that technology can, just improve the teaching, whether it's an environmental history class or not. You know, something that you discuss is the use of Twitter, for instance, to encourage students to ask questions and, you know, kind of make sure that they're taking away what you hope they take away. I'm wondering if you could comment on some of the other side of bringing more technology into the classroom.
You want to start this one in?
No. you were the genius behind the technology cover. And I learned it all from you. So.
It's funny. I'm part of a faculty learning community at the U of A this semester, and we've had several conversations about technology in the classroom, and I am the lone voice in the group about allowing technology in the classroom, having students on their phones, using their laptops, doing stuff in the classroom. So of course, right now I'm feeling uncertain about my convictions, but I have found Google Docs is a godsend for collaborative work for a variety of reasons. One, students themselves can collaborate, and it doesn't matter how busy they are or what time their different jobs are and all that stuff. They can still write stuff and create collaborative projects together via Google Docs in really, really important ways. And that's really kind of available to anybody. So that's really cool. And then as the professor, you can be in on that and see the work and see the evolution of it. And it takes quite a bit of effort to do that, but it's totally worth it. And it pays off. Mm-hmm. And then helping students, for me, part of this is about sort of my political objectives in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I'm not ashamed to say that I have them, because I do want citizen education to be a little bit stronger than maybe it is at the moment.
Right.
For folks in the United States. And I think teaching students how to use Snapchat and Twitter in ways that are productive and somewhat intellectually deeper than just kind of the, you know, more cultural and leisurely recreational fun ways that they use it, that it can also be a real tool for intellectual sharing, is powerful for them. And they often come in, at least my students have come into my classroom, and this was true when I taught high school also, thinking about Snapchat or Twitter or any of those things as sort of either play spaces or spaces where cruelty happens, mm-hmm. where it's not generative and not spaces where we can build a better society and build better selves. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the objective in using Twitter and doing all of that stuff is not only to check in on whether or not they're quote unquote, you know, engaging and getting what we're talking about in class, but also to think about how they can interact and interface with these kinds of technologies when they go out into the world and into their personal lives well beyond the semester or the term that we're together. And so mm-hmm. I use them I'm not being very specific about specific assignments that I do, because they're kind of detailed, but that's sort of my pedagogical principle behind it, is that I think it's something they use anyway. It's something they're often really familiar with, so it feels like kind of comfortable and cool for them to be able to interact with technology and with each other through technological means. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of enriches the classroom in ways that is familiar to most of the traditional students sitting in our classrooms. Mm-hmm. And that helps them. It helps sort of demystify the learning experience, because they're doing it through a venue that they're used to, if I'm making any sense. I've had students use blogs, right? Blogs are super powerful and cool. I've had students, my big thing right now is digital story maps. They're all about, these are the coolest things ever. You know, just Adobe Spark is pretty easy to use. And then you've got this movement in the presentations and movement. So I'm asking them to write an academic essay and then translate it into a digital story so that other people can see it. And that's been really powerful and cool. And they like that creative, that opportunity to be creative. So it hits different learners differently. There are those who've mastered the academic arts, you know, of writing formal essays. And then there are those who are just like, I just can't do that. I just don't like doing it. It's not my skill set. And so this way they have to write an academic essay and work on something that challenges them, but then they get their creative, you know, creative mojo going on. Mm-hmm. And so in all those ways, I think it's just a different way for them to continue to demonstrate their learning and interact with one another and the outside world in ways that are compelling and that hold them accountable in ways that sort of the private aspect of simple essay writing doesn't necessarily do.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I this semester, I'm having my environmental history students, I gave them the option of a traditional essay or an online essay where they, you know, write something shorter, but they build a website. And you're right, there's something about the digital that really appeals to them. The vast majority of my students chose to do a website. And, you know, they're coming in this week, so I haven't had a chance to look at them yet. But from what I've seen, like, they really put a lot into it. Like, it's something that kind of does tap into the sort of stuff that they're used to, getting back to kind of meeting students where they are, but also kind of maybe sparks their creativity in ways that maybe that traditional essay doesn't.
Right. Exactly. Yep.
And I would also say that we said at the outset that a lot of faculty don't talk about their teaching. They sort of feel insecure or don't feel that they would get support or advice and perhaps be sort of ridiculed. And I would say that technology is an enormous space of vulnerability for faculty.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you heard me at the beginning, right? I just demonstrated it. No, I don't want to talk about it.
Well, and me too, because I'm in that faculty learning community and they're all like, no, there are no phones in my classroom. I'm like, oh my God, am I doing this wrong?
Right. And I would say that I have found that with students, admitting that vulnerability is actually a way of enhancing the confidence of our students. And so it's a way of sort of believing in the capacity of our students to adapt and also allowing ourselves that generosity and that space to do it as well. I have a colleague who's a graphic designer and, you know, he's much younger than I am and he did not get his degree that long ago, but everything he learned is now obsolete. Right. And so every sort of new design software is something he has to learn with his students. And I don't think those of us that are historians, right, for the reason that we like things that are analog and antiquated and everything else, we are less likely to sort of say, oh, I don't know how this works. Let's learn it together. And let's kind of explore it together. And Adobe Spark, I think that Michelle's doing, is an amazing place for that. ArcGIS story maps is something that, you know, wasn't available 5 years ago, but it's another website formula, like you were talking about, Josh, to have our students think about what audience beyond just their professor they can express the new ideas that they've learned for. And I think that's the power of technology. And I think it is a really empowering place to set students up for sort of future lives of public service or of sort of dedication to a community.
Right. And I appreciate what you said about basically modeling vulnerability, because I think too often when we feel insecure, we kind of, we wall up and, you know, become resistant to meeting students where they are. But once we show them that it's okay to say, I don't know something and to work on it. That's always beneficial for everyone. And some of the, Michelle, you mentioned like not shying away from having some political objectives in your class. And I think one of the areas of the book where we see that is, you know, you kind of lay out in global context and American context ways in which you can integrate more direct engagement with environmental justice into a curriculum. You know, real briefly, I'm wondering, you know, what how maybe a couple ways that you've done that or a single way and, you know, how that's worked.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Go ahead. I took the last one first.
Okay. Well, I think, I mean, when we were laying out the agenda for the book and sort of thinking about different categories and different chapters, we literally had environmental justice in every chapter. You know, and so for both of us, it's something that we couldn't envision teaching an environmental class without, and without at least consideration of race, class, and gender, and, you know, age and experience and power, and the way that those result in either disproportionate effects of
environmental toxicity or in, you know, sort of the lack of access to the things that make a life sustainable. And so we could see it everywhere, but we also wanted to name it. Mm-hmm. And we decided really deliberately to name it in conjunction with some radical pedagogical techniques, which are, as Michelle mentioned earlier, student-centered, but really project-based and problem-based learning are one of the most powerful ways we think of providing students the opportunity to not just sort of explore the intellectual arena of environmental justice, but to actually think about improving their own problem-solving techniques and capacities in a place that allows them the space to do it and that is still kind of grounded in works of historical significance and historical training. And so we pair those in the chapter, the idea of having a project in your class that's student-driven and also exploring the field of environmental justice through that project is a really sort of powerful way if you have space in your curriculum where you can, you know, manage to cut out things that give you the room to do it, that it can be one of those things that is unforgettable for students.
Yeah, it was interesting. One of the things that has stuck with me from readers' reports in writing the book early on was this question about, I think it was about this particular chapter, but maybe just in general, sort of this question about whether or not what we advocate for in a lot of places in the book is actually quote unquote history, right? And that at what point are you no longer doing history when you're having students look at current environmental justice issues and asking them to come up with policy ideas for how to prevent future environmental injustices and how to rectify the ones that have already happened. And, you know, that's just a matter of your preference, I think. And I think for Emily and I both, history is best when it's applied. And so if you've done a good job throughout your course of getting students to think complexly and analytically about past moments of environmental injustices, and change, and just even just change over time, whether that, you know, perspectives, that was progress, that was declension, all those historiographical questions. When you get students, if you're doing that for 2 or 3 months, you're building them up so that when they go out to do some kind of problem-based work, they're going to hopefully always be thinking historically, right? Like, how did this come to be how it is? And what law that was passed in the 1970s led to this particular moment in time, or, right, et cetera. And so hopefully they're going to always bring their historical thinking to bear on any kind of problem that you're asking them to think about and to potentially offer solutions for. And I find in my classroom that when students are asked to do their own, they get to choose their own topics, they get to do their own research, and then they get to come up with their own solutions. Just yesterday, I had my last class in one of my classes, and they were like, I've never felt so empowered. I'm used to just always hearing about all the problems. Like, I'm just used to hearing about how messed up our system is and how, you know, unjust everything is. And no one's ever asked me to be like, okay, well, how do you fix it? And it was hard to come up with the fix, but I came up with a couple of cool ideas, and I think they might work. And I feel inspired by that. And so again, it's about empowering students, and it's asking them to get dirty, but also this doesn't have to be about partisan politics. This just has to be about thinking about power.
Right.
And students see it all the time. And I think it's important for us to equip them to handle it in intellectual ways. And I think that's some of the best work we can possibly do.
Well said. Yeah. You know, so I've taken up a lot of your time, so maybe I'll conclude with a final question, which is, you know, most of us who are historians, we generally, you know, learning is a collaborative process. We all acknowledge that, even research is, but the actual writing process is typically not. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit about what this process was like for the two of you. You know, what sort of challenges did you face, and, you know, how did this process bear fruit for you?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, that, you know, collaborative writing and co-writing, co-authoring isn't for everyone. And certainly neither of us could do it with everyone. You know, I mean, I think there are certain personality types and there's certain, you know, sort of styles that lend themselves to it. And so part of it's kind of knowing yourself and how you write and what you need. So I think that part of that was us working through that together. I think it also really helped that we're not just professional
colleagues. And so when I would get stuck and I would send Michelle a text and be like, what do I do? Mm. You know, there's a lot of support in that process. But I would also say that we both were really for different reasons, not kind of bound by conventional academic sort of presuppositions mm-hmm. about what counts and what matters. And yeah. I think that was also sort of a release. You know, we weren't trying to please someone else. We were trying to do something that we saw as important and, you know, hopefully changing at least one course. So thank you, Josh.
Yes.
You have admitted that
it did.
Did one thing. But yeah, no, I mean, writing is always hard. And I always tell my students that the hardest thing that they can do is write, and that that's why professors get sabbaticals, and that's why we take time off. And, you know, I talk to them about how difficult it is. And I mean, I think we should talk to each other about that too. And sometimes having someone else's voice in your head as you write helps the process along and helps. I fully believe that the book is 200%. It's not that we each did 50%.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I like that. And I would just add that we did three things. We laughed. We met deadlines, and we forgave each other. I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but like we had a lot of fun, and you know, like we did. I don't think we missed a single deadline that we had set for each other. And then if we met the deadline and what we sent was maybe not quite what we wanted it to be, we'd just say, you know, hope you can forgive me for this. It's my best attempt at the moment, and we always expected that we were both giving, like she just said, 100% to the effort. And in that way, it not only went pretty fast, but it was full of a lot of joy, at least for me. And so, you know, it does help that we do have a friendship. But it was also important that we just really were having fun with it, you know, just
right.
enjoyed it.
Well, I enjoyed it too. And I think everyone who picks up a copy will enjoy it. So Emily, Michelle, I want to thank you for being on the show today. That's a wrap for this episode of New Books in Environmental History.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you.